into the Persian, into the English language. He has been so influential, Hafez, that much of Ottoman poetry was based upon the model of his poetry. The greatest commentary upon Hafez was written by a Bosnian from Mostar called Sudi. Sudi was not a Turk, as everybody thinks. He was from Bosnia. In fact, he was from Sarajevo, and later on lived in Mostar, which was the center of Persia. All the way from there to Chinese commentaries upon Hafez. And in Urdu also, the greatest poets are poets who combine religious concern with great art, like Ghalib, Asadullah Khan Ghalib, Bidel, were all Sufi poets. But not all the great poets had to be Sufi, but at least they had to be concerned with ethical issues. And people who are simply panegyrists, they then occupy a lower level. But even they hold a much higher position in Islamic society than poetry holds, unfortunately, in most of the languages of the West today. Even English, which is very rich in poetry in comparison with French. English is one of the richest languages, I think, in Europe in poetry, along with Spanish and then German. But nevertheless, the role that the poet plays socially, politically, is not what it plays in the Islamic world. Look at, for example, the Palestinian tragedy, how much poetry has produced. Iraqi poetry. Iraq is under the oppression of all of these people from the time of Hassan al-Bakr. Some of the greatest poetry has been produced in Iraq, Arabic poetry. And then poetry also in the Islamic world plays a very important role as psychological therapy. All the way from Sufi poetry, which by just reading it, you feel cured. And every Pakistani in this room knows some Urdu poems that his father would recite at a moment of sadness, and instead of getting paid $90 an hour to a psychologist, a psychiatrist, that would soothe him and cure him, to an outlet in countries which are having a lot of problems, politically or economically, like Egypt. Every week, poems come out of Egypt, which are really parodies of the political situation, making jokes of this and that, but it plays a very important social role. You have some of this in the United States. I'm not saying there's none. But here it's caricatures in the Washington Post or New York Times that takes this place. It's poetry that still plays this role in throughout the Islamic world. I know of no Islamic culture in which poetry does not play a major role. Every language, I say, from Fulani in Africa to Malay. The creation of music is much more complicated. I wish I had time to devote a whole hour to this. I just gave a lecture at Harvard University 2 months ago on Islam and music, which is going to come out as an art book that Harvard is doing, and also in the book Islamic Art and Spirituality, a chapter, two chapters on music, where I talk about the spiritual significance of music. I don't have time to go into all of that. If you want to read about that, it's easily available. But let me say a few words about it. On the one hand, again, we hear that Islam bans music. And you will hear some Muslims on campuses and say Islam against music. On the other hand, you see these great traditions of music now performing on American campuses, classical Persian music, northern Indian music, which is as much Islamic as Hindu, all of its great masters of 700 years, 600 years since Amir Khosrow have been 90% of the Muslims. Nobody talks about it now because part of Indian nationalism to present Indian music as a great manifestation of Indian art, taking out the Islamic element, even if their people are called Reza Ghuli Khan and Velayat Khan and so forth and so on, these are irrelevant. But it's, that was developed as a vehicle for the expression of Persian and Urdu poetry. The very instrument, the sitar, means sitar in Persian, that is having 30 strings. The very name is Persian. It's not a Sanskrit name. It was invented by Amir Khosrow, who migrated from Persia, what is today Afghanistan, to Delhi, and who composed 500,000 verses of Persian poetry in Delhi. More copious than anyone who ever lived in the Persian world. But he was a great hero in Muslim India. And then, of course, Andalusian music, Musiq al-Andalus, the Moroccan Andalusian music, which is so popular now in Spain. Every time you give a concert in Granada, it's always sold out, which is the old music that survived flamenco music, which has a very important Islamic element, but developed in Spain, which is so close to Arabic and Persian music and all of these things. So what's going on? And also, anyone who hears the Quran knows that that is music. You can jot down its notes. But the word music is never used for the Quran. That's already the ambiguity. The word music in Arabic is the same as English. It comes from Greek, al-musiqa, which is the Arabization of the Greek word, which is also coming to English. So we have common word. That word is never used for the chanting of the Quran. But nevertheless, it's musical. So the highest form of music, which is not only legitimate, but accepted by all the ulama, all the scholars, is the chanting of the Quran. And that complements the calligraphy. It's the supreme sonoral art of Islam, is the Quranic chanting. There's no art that is as important as it. It is through the chanting of the Quran that non-Arab Muslims participate in the world of the Quran, much more than understanding the meaning. You don't have to understand the meaning of the Quran to cry when you hear the Quran recited in Trangano or in Bengal. If you ever go to faraway places, let's say in a village in Trangano where nobody knows a word of Arabic, you put a tape of Sheikh Abdul Samad or even some local Sheikh who Qari, we call him Arabic Qari, singer of the Quran, everybody will begin to cry. It's not the rational understanding, and many people do not understand why this is so. The music penetrates the being, that is the Quranic chanting, above the cerebral level. I always give this example. It's like people who do not know harmonic structures of Western music, but when they hear B minor mass, their hair stands on end. They're scintillated by hearing a Beethoven symphony, but if you say analyze this music, they can't do it. They don't know a major key from a minor key. So what? It's the total gestalt experience that moves them. Now the Quran does that on the supreme level. And the only thing that compares to it is you don't have that, unfortunately, in the Christian religion today, is of course the traditional Gregorian chant, the medieval chant in Latin, but which was still liturgical and not sacred, but really the chanting of Hebrew in the Hebrew service and the chanting of the Vedas for Hinduism. But those languages are sacred languages for those religions, whereas in Christianity, Latin is a liturgical language, not a sacred language, but nevertheless developed the sacred art of the plain song, which is so powerful that I was just in Spain a few months ago, and one of my Spanish friends said that the bestseller cassette in Spain is Gregorian chant the last few months. It was unbelievable. After, you know, all of this rock and roll and so forth, many of the young are turning to hear the Gregorian chant, which has something also with the permanence of sacred art. It touches another level of the psyche. Anyway, below the Quran, which is supreme music, which is accepted by everyone, stand certain forms of functional music, you might say, which are accepted by everybody, including based on the hadith of the Prophet. For example, music of marching to war, that is military music. The volume of the military band, as some of you know, came to the West from the Ottomans. That's why the Mozart Turkish March and all of these things, and from the Janissary bands. There are no medieval bands, military bands. There were always some kind of rudimentary music, usually beating on drums, to increase one's sort of state of mind and courage and so forth. You have also among African tribes and all over the world. But an elaborate military band was developed by the Janissaries, which then gradually in the 17th century, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire began to adopt. By the 18th century, they had become popular and then influenced the music of Haydn and Mozart and all these others. And then it entered into America and other places in the West. Or, for example, harvest songs, things like that. That is, peasant singing where they're collecting the harvest, things like that. These are all listed according to Islamic law. They're not haram. They're completely accepted. And music at weddings, the Prophet himself directed when it was a wedding, people playing tambourine, and somebody said, oh, don't do this. He said, no, leave them alone. This is a moment of joy. And in the most restricted ambience in Saudi Arabia, anywhere else, for weddings, you have it among the Bedouins, and you have it also in the cities, and kind of a caravan songs, which were always very famous and very beautiful, which have now almost disappeared, but the music has been preserved. With the bells of the camels as they get up, they used to sing. And there are some very, very beautiful melodies associated with the moving of the caravan, which sort of, whose rhythm is like with the moving of the camels, and which have entered into both Arabic and Persian classical music, and other things like this. I will not burden you with that. Then you have another category of music, which occupies an ambiguous position in the hierarchy of the arts in Islam, because it is not really meant for everybody. And that is the classical traditions of Islamic music, which are really mystical, even if taken over from either Sasanid music, or the pre-Islamic Iranian music, which was extremely rich, which developed the santur, the tar, all of these instruments which are sort of father or mother instruments, like the guitar, which comes from the tar, Persian tar with the two bellies and the name is still there, or the sitar and all of these things, and also the santur, which is the goes all the way from koto to the sether and the father of the harpsichord. And the Sasanid period was very, very rich in music. The Umayyads and the Abbasid took it over, and one of them, Zaryab, came with the Umayyads to Spain. And so not Arabic, but Persian music was taught, in fact, in Cordoba. And that is why parts of flamenco sound much more like Persian singing than Arabic singing. Part of it is like Arabic music. So the classical Persian music, classical Arabic music, classical Turkish music as it developed later on, and North African music, and the Musiq al-Andalus, that is the North African Islamic music. When I say Musiq al-Andalus, I do not mean Spanish music presented, but what is called Musiq al-Andalus in Morocco, which has its own orchestras and so forth, and it's very elaborate. All of them, so Eastern Arabic music, Western Arabic music, Turkish, Persian, North African, which are the major schools of music in the Islamic world, and then smaller schools like the Sundanese music of Indonesia, incredibly beautiful Sundanese music. All of these were developed in conjunction with the inner life, with mysticism and the Sufism especially. And it's on this domain that Islam discouraged sort of public social music, like you have in the West, which in a sense, spiritually speaking, is a kind of expansion without the needed contraction. If I can just be very rapid here, and Evelyn Underhill in the Book of Mysticism says that in all mystical paths there is a stage of contraction, that is purification, a kind of inner death, an expansion, and then union. Contraction, expansion, union. That's a very profound observation. You also have it, of course, in Islamic paths of spiritual realization. But music as it developed in the West, out of its sacred music, gradual profane music, became a kind of expansion without contraction. I mean, when you hear that's the Brahms First Symphony or some of the Beethoven symphonies, you have got a kind of cosmic expansion. But there is not that contraction before. And so it doesn't have a deep and abiding spiritual efficacy according to how Islam sees it. Whether it's right or wrong, I will not get into now. But for Islam, music is interiorizing. Music must interiorize us. And therefore, from the very beginning, it was connected. Even if performed at court with the discipline of Sufism, almost all great musicians of these great classical traditions that I mentioned, the great masters were associated with Sufism. And for example, Persian music, of which I know a little bit, and it's one of the greatest schools of music of the Islamic world, and also very important in the history of music, because it is the only music that survives that is the sister of what Pythagoras heard. It's the whole, that upon which the whole theory of music and harmonics was established in the West. We do not know what Greek music was in the Pythagorean period. There have been some reconstructions of it. But Persian music goes back to the Achaemenian period. It was a cousin of Greek music, and it's the only one that has survived to our own day with all the changes that Islam brought about in rhythm. It's wedding to poetry. In Islam, always music is wed to poetry. It's always the singing and the music that go together. All of these were developed by Sufis. In Persia, the greatest masters in the Qajar period, which was a period of revivification of classical music, were people like Darvish Khan, Abdullah Khan, who were all members of Sufi orders. And it's my theory that that is why serious music as it goes with Islamic people, cannot be performed without a spiritual discipline. And if it is, if you just have the technical dexterity, the people almost always become either drug addicts or drunkards or something like that. The psyche cannot support such a profound transformation without having either the divine wine that inebriates the soul or its artificial substitution. And that's one of the great problems in the Islamic world, that so many musicians fall off. That's why the people in the Sharia oftentimes oppose them, when the word mutrab, from the word tarab, which is probably the origin of troubadour, according to many scholars in Spain and France, is again a pejorative term, precisely because of this, a kind of lasciviousness. And so you have this mystical music preserved within the Sufi orders, the sama, which some of you all have heard of, sometimes combined with movements of the body, which is very esoteric. It should not be seen in public. And it's only the 20th century that people are able to see the whirling dervishes who are now coming to the United States in November, the most elaborate form of it, established by Jalaluddin Rumi in Konya. But before, it was always secret, and in fact, most of the serious Sufi orders, you will never see their performances to this day. The sama is not meant for the public. But from that grew a whole classical tradition, which as long as it remained sober and classical, was accepted by Islamic society as a whole. Even in Mecca, you have some of the most beautiful music you can imagine. Nobody would seize it. But some of the most classical music in Arabic, which was not affected by Aida as Egyptian music was, and 19th century bombastic Italian opera, I always say from Monteverdi to Verdi, what a decline from the point of the quality of the music. In Mecca, even, you still have an orchestra. I mean, you're from Saudi Arabia, probably looking at me like that, but I've attended a concert in a home. It's not public. It survives. It's a music, as long as it's not lascivious, is accepted in the hierarchy, and certainly is extremely important within the mystical dimension of Islam. And then you have this borderline case of what you do with music which is classical, but which is not performed or appreciated by those whose soul has been trained for this music. And then below that, a music is which is banned, is not in the hierarchy of the Islamic arts as Islamic art, but which survives very much in Islamic society. And this is sort of this popular, passionate music that you connect with, let's say, a belly dancing in cabarets in Cairo or something like that, which always existed. It's not modern, but it's extended a great deal during the last century. The best example of that, which as you see today, is the immigration of 1 million Iranians to the United States, to 600,000 of them to Los Angeles. Many of them were cut off from the deepest layers of their own culture. Many of them, what they knew of Persian culture was popular Persian music, popular singers, some whom had great quality, but they would have whiskey in one hand and singing Hafiz on the other hand. That's what made Iran explode in many ways. And they've developed what even the rest of the Iranians in exile and people in Tehran call Los Angeles music. That is Persian Los Angeles music, which is preserving something which no longer has any base in Iran itself. Whereas in Iran, with the closing of the nightclubs and this kind of thing, and paying $5,000 for some singer to sing for half an hour because some nouveau-rich person wants to impress his friends and so forth and so on, with the closing of that, the music has turned completely back to the classical music. This is one of the great paradoxes, and I will conclude with this comment, which is very telling. When the Iranian Revolution took place in Persia, one of the great centers of music, all music was banned at the beginning, on radio and television and everything. There was no music for several months, for almost a year. Then the national television realized that that's an impossibility. They went to Ayatollah Khomeini himself, and after a discussion, for the first time after nearly 2 years, you would never guess, the first piece of music that was played on the national radio of Iran was the Eroica Symphony of Beethoven, Symphony No. 3. Sorry, you can play classical Western music, because in the Muslim mind, that doesn't have anything to do with moving the certain parts of the body, you know, and becoming sexually excited. It appears to the Muslim mind as a kind of science of sound. And all right, the few people who can understand the Eroica, let them listen to it. For a while that went on, until the brother of the present president of Iran, Rafsanjani, became the head of the national radio and television. That was about 1986 or so. And then he wrote on purpose, with the help of his brother, an official letter to Ayatollah Khomeini, which was published in all the Iranian newspapers, asking him directives, what do we do with music? And Ayatollah Khomeini gave one of the most important historical fatwas that had ever been given in the history of Islamic art, which is very interesting. A man like him, who had it not been interested, had another dimension to him besides being a ruthless ruler who ordered people to be killed. He also, in his youth, had composed poetry, composed very good Persian poetry, which is amazing, and which was published after his death. And he loved Sufism, and he spent 30 years studying Ibn Arabi, and so forth and so on. Very, nobody knew his other side. Now Alexander Knish has written something about it. This Russian scholar is now in Michigan. Some people know about this. Anyway, Ayatollah Khomeini gave a remarkable fatwa, which has never been given in the history of Islam, by an alim in this position of power. Probably very few ulama in the history of Islam have had the power of him. Maybe just three or four, but anyway. He gave the fatwa that all classical Persian music is accepted as being halal, should be performed. And any form of music which does not incite the passions towards sin is acceptable. The only thing that is opposed is that women singers should not sing in public for men. They can sing for women, because the woman's voice, being so beautiful, might incite men, even if they're singing, mystical love songs. It might be misconstrued. So, and there is foundation of that fatwa. Starting the next morning, of course, everybody was waiting. The Persians are very musical. They started from morning to night performing music. And it's incredible, the revival of classical Persian music in this country. I was telling David about it some time back. I had a friend in America, Farhang Sharif, who is the greatest performer of the tar, who is like Yehudi Menuhin or Yasha Heifetz on the violin. I mean, one of the two, three greatest performers, who came into exile. He lived in Los Angeles and in Washington. He was very depressed and finally decided to go to Iran. After 15 years, he was received, actually, can I say like a king, because the king would not be well received in Iran, but I don't know what kind of metaphor to use, but anyway, like a great hero. And he wrote back last week. He said, I have had over 700 requests for students to study with me. Because in the old days, we would have 7 or 10. And the first appointment for an audition has to wait for 8 or 9 months down the road. He said, it's unbelievable the interest in classical music. And a younger generation of very great singers and musicians are coming up in Iran, where we would least expect it. Because that type of sort of popularized music is stopped. And once you're stopped from the outside, you have no way but to go inside. And you don't make a tremendous amount of money either. You have to do it for the love of the music and the discipline. So the question of music in Islam is a very, very difficult and ambiguous art. And as Jean-Louis Michon, in his wonderful essay called Music and Sacred Dance in Islamic Spirituality, two volumes which I edited for the Encyclopedia of Spirituality. Anyone seriously interested in music should read that essay. That's the best thing in the English language. The famous French authority on Islamic thought and art wrote. He said perhaps it was in God's wisdom that there was never a firm directive, either in Quran or Hadith, concerning music. It had to remain ambivalent in this way to both prevent an excessive lasciviousness and on the other hand, preserve and keep the door open for classical music, which is always interiorizing. Yehudi Menuhin came to Iran in the 1960s. I was his host. Of course, the great musician he is. He heard for the first time a performance of classical Persian music. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And when it finished, he never heard this. I mean, music is like a language. It's my hearing Bengali for the first time. You have to get used to the language to get the message, but being the great musician he was, tears came to his eyes. He said, all that I can say is that this music is like a ladder between the soul and God. When you climb it, that's the only way you can reach. So you have this interiority of music in a civilization which is supposed to be against music. And it's this sense of ambiguity which really defines the whole field of musical art, but which nevertheless remains extremely important in the context of Islamic civilization. All right, I'm 7 minutes over time, and that's enough for tonight. And I'll give my last talk tomorrow, where we talk about form, and especially content of form, relation between form and its essence in Islamic art. Thank you.